This TFMR podcast is brought to you by your friends at JM Bullion. Visit jmbullion.com for all your gold and silver bullion needs. Well, greetings, everybody, at TFMR. It is time for your Thursday conversation. And this is significant because of the time of the year. It's basically probably going to be the last Thursday conversation we have. Next Thursday will be the day after the FOMC. So we'll want to have a regular podcast. And then by the next Thursday, it'll be almost Christmas. So this is the last one of the year. So I sat here and thought, who could I get that would be a good person to talk about the year that was, the year that's to come? And of course, first name that comes to mind is Dave Kranzler, our old friend Denver Dave, who runs the great website Investment Research Dynamics and the subscription-based newsletters that you should be reading, not only the Short Sellers Journal, but particularly the Mining Stock Journal for what we discuss here. Dave always does great work, and he is a good friend from way back. Dave, thank you for joining me to try to wrap up this crazy year.
Hey, Craig, how's it going? Thanks for spreading all that disinformation about me in the intro.
It's going to get me banned from Twitter. coming after me. All right, Dave, but let's start with your newsletter, but particularly Mining Stock Journal, because things are picking up. I mean, the chart of the GDX looks tremendous. Obviously, gold's above 2,000. I mean, people hear me say this all the time. You can try to do all this yourself, but you need some people with a trusted source of information. Tell everybody about Mining Stock Journal and how that works.
Sure. So I write it and release it every 2 weeks on Thursday after the market closes. And I'm always looking for new ideas, but I basically have a list or portfolio of stocks that I cover and recommend, and I invest in most of them. And it's got an emphasis on the junior, I call them the project development microcap stocks, because junior miners is kind of a broad term. You know, they call GDXJ a junior ETF, but the average market cap in there is like $1 billion or something. I mean, my favorite stocks to look at and where I think there's the greatest amount of alpha to be earned is with the micro caps that are trading, you know, under $30 million. So, and if you pick the right ones, I mean, you can make a lot of money in a good market. So, I also cover some producers, like Caliber Mining. And so it's you know, I balance it out somewhat with and I the producers I look at tend to be more like the mid caps. And, you know, the reason why I start following them and recommending them is for whatever reason, you know, I've decided that they're stupidly undervalued versus what they're, you know, what they're producing and what they have and what their assets and the potential of their assets
versus all the rest that are undervalued. That's I'm just laughing.
That's I'm sorry.
Somebody, I'm laughing versus all the rest that are undervalued. Somebody asked me the other day about which ones I own. I'm like, why do you even care? I mean, I own the same turds as everybody else. but maybe, you know, again, I think it's important because we've been waiting for this change of Fed policy all year, and it's been kind of delayed, maybe got pushed back 4 or 5 months. And as we record this here, today's actually the 6th as you and I are talking, and we're a week away from the next FOMC, and there's a 99.99% chance there's no rate hikes. And we're actually starting to see a possibility of a rate cut even as soon as January, which would I think was probably getting a little too aggressive. It seems on the edge of the next easing cycle, no matter how that plays out, and gold's already $2,000. What do you expect? What are you looking at as, let's just say, as this year comes to a close and as the new year begins?
What I'm looking at in terms of the economy, the banking
system. Yeah, let's start there, the economy and how that might impact, you know, what the Fed does in monetary policy next year.
Sure. Well, first of all, I'd argue that the next easing cycle's already started. you know, it's not, you know, it's the Fed policy has two sides, right? How they regulate the money supply or the liquidity in the banking system, and then how they regulate the cost of money or the interest rates. So, I mean, they started reliquefying the banking system in March, right?
Yeah.
When they dumped in $400 billion to you know, ostensibly to save the regional banks, you know, so they didn't have to sell their 10-year duration AAA assets at a big loss. I got to wonder why they were sitting on a loss position if these are AAA assets, but you know, that's for another day. It was really to cover the ass of the uninsured depositors, which were, you know, wealthy dudes and corporations. So, and then they made that bank term funding program available, and they never specified a size limit, and it's supposed to be paid back in March, but the damn thing keeps getting larger almost on a weekly basis, which means there's banks tapping into it, which means they need liquidity. So, and I'm sure you've seen, you know, there's a couple different financial conditions in indices out there. Goldman has one. I forget who creates the other
Citi.
One. Maybe
Citi does the other one.
Citi or yeah. maybe Bloomberg. I don't know. It doesn't matter. But, you know, the financial conditions have eased considerably. I mean, you know, the ease of financial conditions is about as high as it's been at any time since the Fed restarted QT. So, you know, and then they can point to their balance sheet and say, see, we're reducing it. But there's other ways that they can put liquidity into the system. You know, part of it right now is they're draining that reverse repo facility.
Yeah.
You know, and I looked at that when it was, you know, a year ago, and I'm like, that, you know, it was almost at $2.5 trillion at that point. And I'm like, ah, so that's how they're going to fund treasury issuance for a while. And that's what they've been doing, right? I mean,
right.
They've been issuing T-bills because a lot of that money that's in that reverse repo facility comes from money market funds. And now the money market funds are buying short-term T-bills that are being issued, you know, and taking their money out of the reverse repo facility. I mean, if you ask me, the Fed's already started easing its monetary policy. But, it, you know, and in terms of the economy, I mean, you and I were discussing earlier about, you know, how Orwellian and disinformational the system has gotten. And, you know, you keep hearing, oh, you know, we're avoiding a soft landing. There's not going to be a recession. Well, that's a bunch of BS, because
right.
If you look at the hard economic data, most sectors of the economy are already in a pretty ugly recession, particularly manufacturing.
They spin it with headlines that then get revised lower.
Well, it's that thing. If it's the Joseph Goebbels adage, right?
Yeah.
If you repeat a lie enough times, eventually the majority of the people will come around to believing it. So if you just keep telling them there's no recession, well, guess what? There's no recession, right?
Right. Right.
You know, meanwhile, people are tapping into credit card lines. And I don't know if you saw that report out that on Black Friday, like the use of the buy now, pay later lines of credit soared. And that's expensive credit, the buy now, pay later. I mean, you're talking, you know, some of those outfits have interest rates that are more expensive than credit cards right mm-hmm. now. So you got to be pretty desperate if you're tapping into one of those for your holiday spending.
And Dave, you track the housing market pretty closely. That they, you know, you keep getting these headlines that make people think that it's holding in there okay. How might the housing market impact things?
I mean, I don't know how you can say it's holding in there, and I can't remember the actual numbers off the top of my head. I actually had it in my last short seller's journal. Let me see if I can find it. But I mean, existing home sales on a year-over-year basis have been declining for something like, so I mean, you look at existing home sales, and there is some merit to saying, well, you know, part of the reason is because of low inventory. Well, we have low inventory because even before the Fed started hiking rates and mortgage rates went through the roof, people couldn't afford to, when you live in a house and you sell it, you're either retiring and you're moving to a townhome, right? Or moving to Florida, or you're moving up. And, people in a home where they might that are living in a home where they might consider moving up to a nicer home, a more expensive home, can't afford to do that. And so, I mean, that's part of the reason that the I call them used homes. That's why part of the reason the used home inventory has been so low. I mean, it's the Fed created that problem with its monetary policy. So in for November, and they put out this seasonally adjusted annualized rate, right? And it's a BS metric, but they take the monthly rate, adjust it seasonally, which who knows what goes into that witch's brew, and then they annualize that rate. And so any of the statistical errors from the seasonal adjustments get magnified when you annualize that number. But it dropped down to just under 4 million on an annualized rate basis. It's the lowest since August 2010. And new home sales, I mean, it's the same thing. And the new home sales number is probably one of the most unreliable, statistically unreliable metrics put out by the government. And it's wildly volatile. So for instance, when they reported October sales, which were down 5.6% from September, remember the somehow, and everyone was scratching their head, oh, well, September was up 12.3% from August. Well, guess what? They ended up revising it down to something like to 8.6%, and they'll revise it down again next month when they report, or this month when they report November's new home sales in a few weeks. So it's just, but at any rate, it's new home sales now are starting to tank, and part of the reason the new home sales actually went through, I'd call it a mini rally in sales volume, is A, because there was low inventory of used homes, but B, the home builders were slashing prices like crazy. And they were also giving people they're giving people loans so that they could obtain a rate buy-down mortgage, which lets you take, an 8% mortgage and you pay money up front, and you cut the rate to say, I don't know, 5%. This is off the top of my head. That's not a perfect example, but you're able to get the rate reduced so that you can afford the monthly payment. But then on the back end, you end up paying for it. So all it's doing is kicking a can down the road. And it looks like, and I need to see a few more months of this, but it looks like the juice from that has probably, lost momentum. So, with inflation and, you got probably 80% of all households are getting squeezed in terms of their real income and their disposable income. And, that situation is going to be exacerbate going forward. I mean, just because they're telling us the inflation rate's what, 3.8% or whatever it was, I think it was 3.2%. At the latest report, just because they're telling us that's what the inflation rate is, that's not the real rate of inflation that most households are experiencing with not just discretionary items, but with everything that you have to spend money on every month, right? You got to, shelter, whatever form of shelter you have, whatever, keeping your home, heated or air conditioned, putting gasoline in your car. They always seem to be able to push down the price of gasoline around this time of year, and I'm convinced they do it so that it puts a little bit more money in people's pockets to spend on holidays, right?
Make it feel a little better about things.
Exactly. But we'll see. It's a seasonal thing. We'll see the price of gasoline go back up next year.
So where do you fall, Dave, in this? There are some folks out there that think they're going to keep rates. Oh, they're going to keep rates as high as they need to because they got they're going to they're on the side of the people and they're going to get inflation down to 2%. Or are you more in the camp of as soon as there's a problem at all, economically or with the markets, they'll be cutting? Where do you fall in that argument?
I think at some point, and again, for me, the more important factor is what they do with the liquidity in the banking system, the money supply and the amount of liquidity they make available to the banks. And that's where the real price inflation comes from, right? That's because you're devaluing the currency when you do that. I mean, rates, if you use a real inflation index. So I just default to John Williams' shadow statistics. You know, he calculates the alternative CPI using the methodology they used in 1990 and 1980. And 1980 is when they started massaging the calculus and the variables. But, you know, if you go back to how they were doing it in 1980, you still have about 11% rate of inflation, price inflation. So, and that's probably closer to what people are experiencing, you know, on a monthly basis, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So if you look at that, real rates are still negative. I call them real rates, not, you know, the real rates that they cite in the financial media, that's a bogus number.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so the real rates are still negative, and that in and of itself is inflationary. It's devaluative to the currency. I think what the Fed is doing is kind of playing a game of chicken with the currency market, because they have to posture the minute they get off their posture of, you know, higher for longer, you know, the dollar is going to take a shit.
Yeah.
And then you're going to have trouble funding treasuries unless you print money, right? Because if the dollar starts tanking, foreigners aren't going to want treasuries. And also, if you start printing money, yeah, maybe the initial move in interest rates or in the bond market is down. But I'm of the opinion that I think once they start the next QE or money printing program, I hate calling it QE because it's money printing. Let's just call it what it is.
Right.
You know, once they start taking rates down and printing money, I actually think you could start to see a sell-off in the bond market.
And then they have to print more.
Again, not initially.
And then they got to print more.
Exactly. I think the next time they have to crank up the printing presses, I think that's where we go into, you know, hyperinflation.
I would imagine they have to understand that too, but it is a choice they're going to have to make, you know, to keep the plate spinning as long as possible.
I don't know how many of the FOMC members actually understand it.
Well, that's true.
And Yellen doesn't understand it. But no. Yeah, the smart people at the Fed understand it. They know.
But Yellen and, you know, Brainard, who may take over for Powell, depending on who the next president is, that kind of stuff. I mean, they're all MMTers. They all think that that's just fine. So, I don't know. We're probably going to find out, Dave. And we sit here at the beginning of this next year. Like you said, gold's already $2,000. Despite the frantic efforts of the banks to try to paint the charts, they will be overwhelmed. They just bought themselves a little time. But yet, Dave, one of your specialties is the mining shares. And yet they're still, I mean, I guess the GDX is probably up 10% year to date now. Not even keeping track with gold, though. And you look at the chart, the GDX looks fantastic. So I guess, you know, what I'd like to do is kind of pick your brain about a few stocks and see what you think. I mean, you mentioned, you know, kind of focusing on a few exploration companies and some juniors. What do you think of the idea of, just in a broad sense, of the majors moving first? And I always kind of ascribe it to being, you know, when people first start getting interested in gold, you know, they don't know what to do. So they call up their stockbroker and their stockbroker doesn't know. And he just says, well, we'll buy some Newmont. They're the biggest one. Do you what do you think of the majors? I mean, I this is again a long question. I'm sitting here thinking they may have a really good quarter when they start posting at the end of January and in early February, because price is high, but energy costs have come down. What do you think of them? And do you have one or two that you like more than the others?
Newmont and Barrick, I mean, they're bureaucratic behemoths. They move slowly. They make puzzling decisions in a lot of areas. I wouldn't touch those. I mean, if you're thinking of buying Newmont or Barrick, just buy GDX. You're probably going to outperform both stocks.
Yeah, that's true.
With GDX, in terms of the majors, there's probably three that I'd be and so I'm talking about the largest cap mining stocks, not stocks like Hecla or whatever. I actually like Hecla a lot, but I wouldn't consider that a major. I mean, forget what its market cap is off the top of my head, but Agnico Eagle.
Yep.
The guy running that company, these guys are smart and they make great decisions. They make great acquisitions. So I like Agnico Eagle. For me, it's a question of whether you want to chase the sector here, or I mean, I wouldn't, believe it or not, I wouldn't mind seeing a bit of a corrective pullback here before it gets too frothy. Because we've had if you look at the charts, we've had a big move since early October. I like Goldfields a lot, and a lot of times I play call options on that one, and I write about that in my, you know, I let my subscribers know if I'm putting on positions in stocks like Goldfields or Agnico or AngloGold Ashanti. Also, I like that one. That one's kind of lagged in this latest move higher, but I that's another company that I think has really smart management. And I like a lot of the things they're doing in terms of diversifying their asset base. So if you want to go to kind of smaller market cap producers, I mean, and, you know, everyone who's listening to this knows I have this view, but I think Fortuna is just ridiculously undervalued for what it has. If people just don't understand the asset base, and a lot of people don't understand West Africa yet. But West Africa is that may be the best region in the world right now to be a miner.
You went there, didn't you, Dave?
It's low costs. You got a dedicated labor base. Certainly, you know, there's some countries that you want to stay away from. But, you know, like the Ivory Coast, the Cote d'Ivoire, I was over there in July visiting the Séguéla mine. And, I mean, you'd be surprised at least not the parts that we flew over in the helicopter out in the country where, you know, there's still extreme poverty, but, you know, it's not that much different from here. You fly over Appalachia, right?
Right.
But I mean, you know, the major city there, Abidjan, I mean, it was vibrant. You know, there's middle class there, there's upper class there. And, you know, of course there's going to be poverty, but I'm not saying I would move there, but I guess my point is those countries, a lot of those countries over there, several of them are extremely supportive of mining, and, you know, they participate in the profitability of these mines. So they're incentivized to support it.
Yeah.
So, but I bring this up because I think another mining stock that I think is idiotically undervalued is B2 Gold. And I mean, you know, you collect a little bit north of a 5% dividend on that stock while you wait for the market to come to its senses on what B2 Gold has. And so, you know, and that's one that I reviewed a couple months ago in my newsletter and recommended purchasing it, and I own it. So, you know, I put my money where my mouth is on these. So, and that's probably, I mentioned Caliber Mining, and again, it's, you know, I think part of the reason why it's undervalued there is, you know, their primary asset base is in Nicaragua. And I again, it's, you know, yeah, there's political risk there, but there's political risk in this country.
Well,
right?
Yeah.
There's political risk in Canada.
Yeah, Canada too.
So, you know, and the reason why I don't think that the mines would be nationalized there is because who's going to run them if you nationalize them?
Well, that leads me to, I don't know if you have an opinion on what's going on with Franco-Nevada and, you know, everything's going on in Panama. Do you, have you been following that?
I don't really follow the streamers that much.
Okay.
I
like, no, that's
I
fine.
Like Sandstorm.
Right.
But I just don't, I think with these streamers, I don't know. So what my MO is I like to look at names where there, I think the market is inefficiently pricing it. And there's so many eyeballs on Franco-Nevada or Royal Gold that I just think it's hard to outperform the sector investing. And I'm not saying it's not a good company, but it's hard to outperform the sector, you know, with stocks like that. So, I've been kind of sort of following what's going on in Panama. When I first looked at First Quantum, like, I'm not taking Panama risk. And I looked like an idiot for a while, but, you know, now look what's going on.
Right.
So, in fact, I hadn't even looked at Franco-Nevada's stock, and I'm looking at it now. It's like, ooh, holy crap.
Well, that's the thing that makes it, I mean, their market cap has been reduced by a third from once, as it's gone from 160 to 105. But yet, that mine, that whatever it's called, Cobra of Panama or whatever the heck it is, represents 17% of their royalty asset base. So it's like, well, is that getting a little overdone? I don't know. It's just another example of, as solid as that company look, man, you just never know with, you know, the jurisdiction risk and that kind of stuff. Let me ask you another one that's been in the news lately. Have you ever looked at this Hercules before?
Is Hercules silver or something?
That Hercules silver, yeah. It went from 15 cents to a dollar. Newmont put some money. I think it was Newmont put some money into them. I just didn't know if that was one that you, if you don't know anything about it,
I looked at it. I've had subscribers asking me to look at it for a while. And the first time I looked at it was way before it took off in price.
Yeah. Sure.
And I was like, well, I want to watch it for a while longer. I don't, you know, I wasn't enthralled with it. And it was getting, I usually like have a disdain for stocks that are overpromoted. And it felt like it was getting overpromoted. But ironically, I think it was actually their copper project. I guess it's copper silver, but it's really the copper thing. Yeah. And so that's the only thing that I use to console myself. Well, it's copper, and copper's not a monetary metal, so I don't really follow the copper stocks, which is true for the most part. And I do buy into the supply demand thesis that's applied to the copper market.
Yeah.
But my personal opinion is that, well, professional opinion also is that the world is going into a really, really nasty recession, period of recession. And, you know, I think that's going to dampen demand for copper for a while. And that said, I mean, it takes a long time to build a copper mine. And I'm not saying that there's not good value in some of these copper, copper projects. But it's just, I don't like to spread myself too thin, and I'd rather really know the gold and silver mining companies that I follow. Sure. I'd rather really know them well. But yeah, believe me, I'm kicking myself on Hercules.
Crazy how, anyway, we'll see where it goes from here. I followed you 6 months ago, I guess. I think it was after you got back from Africa. I bought some Fortuna at like three. So that's working out great. You mentioned B2 Gold. Well, how about, I mean, I got to ask you about a couple more, but is any other one that maybe people should be keeping an eye on that you think is undervalued and could appreciate?
About the producing stocks, right?
Sure. Or if you want to, I'll leave it up to you. Throw one out there.
So the way I like to work is when I find an idea that I think is a great idea, I present it in my newsletter. And then I try to embargo saying anything about it in public until, you know, there's been enough time for my subscribers to look at it and decide if they're going to, you know, take some risk on it. But there's a company called Cabral Gold, and they're down in Brazil. And people might think there's political risk in Brazil, but I it's probably easier to get permitted for a mine in Brazil than it is in Arizona, and maybe even Nevada. And forget California. I won't look at anything in California, because I just don't think you're going to see mines get permitted in California, especially with that nut job running that state.
No, that's true.
But so Cabral Gold has a project down there, and it's an emerging, I mean, it's historically it was a prolific placer mining area, right? And that's the old style mining, where you're basically panning for gold. But as it turns out, from thousands of centuries of rivers flowing through there, there's a ton of gold in that area. And there's so Cabral has a project where there it's again, I'm not a trained geologist, and I haven't visited the mine site, but just from the drilling results and all the areas on their property where they're hitting gold, it looks like it could be, a 3 to 5 million ounce project eventually. But what makes it really interesting is that they on their the existing deposits that they so they have resource estimate out on, and they, so they have two deposits and probably four. They just haven't prepared resource estimates on the other two, but they've got what they're calling a golden oxide blanket that sits on top of the deeper mineralization. And this stuff starts at surface and doesn't go down very far. And it's extreme. It's like mud and soft rock. And it's got on average, based on the assays that have been done so far on the stuff they've assayed, where you're talking about, 2+ grams per ton from this material. And it's as cheap as any they'll be able to process it as cheaply as any processing methodology out there. And so it's going to be extremely profitable material when they process it. They already have a trial mining permit for it. That's Brazil issues what they call a trial mining permit. And so they're in the process of preparing a feasibility study for it. And on the assumption that they'll be able to get financing to build the mine, will be really cheap to build the processing facility. And so I'm not worried about them getting financing unless, the banking system goes dark. But they could be producing gold from these oxide blankets, which, and they're basically zero strip ratio. So the profit margin on this stuff is going to be enormous. They could be producing it by the end of 2024. And based on, I've been trying to press the CEO. The CEO is a great guy, and he's one of the largest investors in the company, and he participates in every financing. So he's really believes in this project, and he's successfully taken projects from project to mine in the past. So he's got pedigree. It sounds like, they could be producing somewhere in the range of 15,000 to 20,000 ounces on an annualized basis
How about
from
that?
this, but, and it doesn't sound like a lot, but if you multiply that out, let's just say they're all in sustaining cost to produce this stuff is probably about $600. So in today's gold market, you're netting $1,400 an ounce. When you multiply that out, they're going to be generating more than enough free cash flow to get the rest of the project advanced. And then you're probably looking at a, again, I would just off the just guesstimating, something that has 3 to 5 million ounces on it. And if you put a mine on that where you're doing 100,000 to 200,000 ounces a year, you're talking about, a company that's probably worth, I don't know, $500 million, just ballpark. I mean, the market cap on it right now is about 20 million.
I was
So
going to say, it's a tiny fraction of that.
yeah. So and the thing is, I think I think the market, first of all, they don't promote themselves to their detriment, but so I don't, a lot of the market's not even aware that this company exists. And then people who look at it might be leery of Brazil. And but, you know, you got to take some risk to get return in this market. And I don't think people understand exactly how far advanced they are in terms of, you know, being a producer within the next year.
Yeah. What was that company name again, Dave? Just
called Cabral Gold. It's CBGZF.
Okay.
Is the OTC bulletin board ticker. And CBR.V is the venture, Toronto Venture.
There's
ticker.
One for everybody to check out. The and level
it's moved. It's moved quite a bit in the last, I don't know, 4 to 6 weeks. Like, it's gone from about 8 cents to 15 cents. Okay. I don't know if I would chase it unless you're confident that we're not going to get some kind of pullback in the sector.
Right. Right. Well, I'm glad that you walked us through that, because I think it's a tremendous advertisement for what you do. Again, I'd never heard of that company, and I'm sure most people listening to us never heard of it. And now they're scrambling. That's why I asked you for the name again, because I'm sure they're like, what was the name of this one again? this is the value. Again, this is the value you get from Dave's service. And so you go to investmentresearchdynamics.com is the website, and you can find right there how to sign up, right, Dave?
Yeah. There's a link at the top, and it takes you to a landing page where it explains the service and the cost, which I probably need to raise the price because it hasn't kept up with inflation, but I'm going to keep it where it is right now.
Well, I think maybe by next year, Dave, when gold's at 2,500 and all these things are soaring, that'd be a good time to do it because you'll have, you know, you'll have everything. I mean, everybody will be happy and we'll be cooking, and it sure looked, I mean, who knows, maybe I'm dead wrong.
But 2,500, sure, are you a pessimist?
Yeah, right. Exactly. Where are you coming? Oh, anyway, Dave, it's always fun to visit with you, my friend. And we will
likewise
certainly do this again in the new year. But I thought it would be fun to kind of wrap up, see where you think things are headed, and get ready for 2024. I hope you have a great Merry Christmas holiday season. I know you're living out in Colorado. I'm sure you go out to big, like, weed smoking parties and stuff on New Year's Eve. Everybody sits there and pass the bong around and
put on some Grateful Dead, man.
Right. Exactly. I'm sure that's, you're all trading. Yeah. Anyway, I'm sure you'll have a great New Year's Eve is what I'm saying. And then we'll get back together in the new year and see where we go from here. Dave, thank you so much for your time, my friend. I value your friendship. I value your the wisdom you share with us, and I hope you have a great holiday season, and we'll see what happens from there.
Thank you too, Craig. And likewise, I value our friendship, and I love these conversations we have.
We kept it pretty tame today, but that's all right. We'll get into it. Anyway, Dave, thank you so much, my friend. And thank you everybody for listening again. This might be the last Thursday conversation of the year, but we'll queue them up at the beginning in January, and it's going to be a heck of a 2024. Again, thanks to Dave, and thanks to everybody for listening, and we'll talk to you again very, very soon.